Well, thank you, Siv, for that kind introduction, and thank you for hosting me here the last 3 days. I really enjoyed it. I'm sorry I have to depart tomorrow for the winter down south. As Siv says, I want to give this talk in two parts. It's partly to rescue me, actually, because I have to say the first part, which you can see, is very, very controversial. Peter Gluckman, one of my co-authors, wrote a very good article, we thought, in Nature a couple of years ago, advocating the kind of theory I'm going to underpin here, and got a lot of flack. I don't know whether many of you saw that in Nature over the last couple of years, and he feels a wee bit exposed, as it were, and he heads up this big Liggins Institute in Auckland, which is an institute devoted to medical research. And when it was refunded for the second 5 years, he approached me and said, I've got to have a math platform in this institute. Will you come and help me with it? And when I looked at the dollars, I said yes. I thought I'd better do that. So this is one of the outputs from the first attempt to underpin what he had said about our gene expression. It's a model for gene expression. He has the view that our genes adopt different phenotypes in our early life, particularly when we're a fetus, but really right up to adolescence. And we're trying to build conceptual models that basically describe this in order to perhaps quantify it. So I emphasize that this is a conceptual model with not much physiological backing. There are other co-authors. Tony Pleasance is someone with whom I've worked. He works in the phenotype development in animals. So what I've got here is generic to all mammals. Then, as Siv says, because I was in London, England last week, giving a talk on pasture growth, and I did a plenary there, and I got a very shortened version of it. Two or three of you, when I've been talking to you over the last couple of days, have emphasized that you're quite interested in delay type equations, and I've got a nice application that came from our agricultural industry. So Siv has given me permission to make that a small add-on at the end. So thank you. There's the outline of the first book, a little bit on the biology. I'll talk about a Japanese gentleman's deterministic model of this. We added to it with a stochastic model, and so on. You can see that it's still undergoing development, but we have now just submitted what I'm talking about today to a journal just 2 weeks ago. Right, the introduction to the biology. And basically you can read that, but let's take it slowly. An organism may express different phenotypes in response to changes in the environment. So this is the textbook definition of plasticity. If you Google it, you might get elasticity type plasticity, but no, we're talking about phenotype plasticity. And it appears to be, and this is Peter Gluckman's view as a medical scientist, it appears to be an important mechanism enhancing an organism's ability to survive and reproduce. And plasticity, therefore, induces a fitness advantage for the organism. This PowerPoint will go on your website in a day or so. Nishimura in 2006, and I've got the reference there, seemed to have been the first person to have a go at mathematizing this. He proposed that an organism faced with a change in environmental circumstances would seek to minimize the energy cost of adapting to the new environment and the energy cost of reproduction. He constructed a simple model, alarmingly simple, undergraduate calculus of a prey in an environment which changes to favor what he called, in inverted commas, predation. The prey may elicit a plastic response to reduce predation, but this response will require energy to induce. Okay, well, that's a lot of words. Well, let's put that into mathematics. Basically, the concepts that we want to embody, at least in the deterministic model, if the predation rate increases, it destroys the fitness. Changes in the characteristics are initiated with consequential changes in the energy content. Now, The Selfish Gene, a book by a gentleman well known around the world, basically had some qualitative ideas that were here. I used to be an admirer of Richard Dawkins. I'm not so sure now, because I think I met him a couple of times in Oxford. He doesn't listen very much, and he makes his mind up before he writes anything and develops an argument to support it. So I must admit I put this on before he wrote the latest book, which I can't stand. But never mind. The ideas that Gluckman has followed are sort of embodied in that book. In epidemiology, a popular theory is that the rising incidence of coronary heart disease and type 2 diabetes in human populations undergoing, as we all are, industrialization, that's due to a mismatch between a metabolic phenotype, a gene expression, determined in development, and the nutritional environment during development to which an individual is subsequently exposed. And in the medical literature, this is called the thrifty phenotype hypothesis. The sort of example that Peter Gluckman uses, and I'm a great supporter of him, I now work with him in this Center of Research Excellence, he has the idea that if a mother has a poor an expectant mother has a poor nutritional intake during the pregnancy, the fetus learns to adapt to its environment by changing its genetic expression, so it learns to store fat. And when the fetus becomes a human being, full human being, and is in later life, that gene expression is set in concrete, as it were, and it can be a cause of obesity. And that is one of the theories. My mother actually looked after me pretty well, though it's not necessarily a one-to-one correlation. Let me explain in part two about Nishimura's deterministic model. It's a nice paper, actually, when we've obviously expanded on it somewhat. Has anyone here seen it? It's in that Journal of Evolutionary Ecology, which is quite good. Anyone here seen it? No? Okay. So I'll explain it anyway. We'll assume we're taking up the concepts of part one, what I've said. We'll assume a prior Pacific death rate of mu 1, right, the per capita death rate, for the prey. And when the environment changes, it has a death rate of mu 2, which is less. So the time at which it switches has been chosen to somehow benefit the organism in which the gene is based. And that the development of the plastic response incurs an energy cost from a base of C0 to C1, with C1 being bigger. So a fitness function W for the suitable currency as a function of time t, and that time is running over a fixed interval. It might be from conception to adolescence, for example, but it's more likely from conception to birth, is something like that. And little t is the time at which that switch happens. So W is measured in energy units, and so you've got the predation effects here. In the first subinterval, mu 1 is the predation rate, so the decrease is e to the minus mu 1. In the second interval of capital T minus little t, the predation rate is mu 2. So that's the downside, that the energy is reduced. And here we've got the energy units e. E is the total energy budget. W we're going to call the plasticity, so they've got the same units. And the CIs are the energy per unit of time energy usage in the two modes. So that's the simplest conceptual model I think you could get in order to embody what we said in words in step one. And remember, I'm just following the Nishimura at this moment. C0 is the default baseline energy cost to the prey, And I've already said this, and C1 includes the additional costs of building and maintaining the defensive phenotype per unit time. And so that I've rewritten it just for simplicity. It's a simple counting exercise. If you accept this conceptual model, and I know you could write down other variations of it, then all you've got to do is freshman calculus differentiate with respect to little t. And you can see you can find a maximum. That's what Nishimura did, and got that expression for the optimal time at which the plasticity is actually maximized. Just simple calculus from going step one to step two. When we came along, we were interested in a cohort of genes and a cohort of population, a whole population. So this means that we had to move from Nishimura's deterministic approach into the stochastic environment. So we needed to introduce variability. Now this is the point at which I'm terribly nervous, because we made some steps that I think need to be refined. As I said, we've only submitted the next bit a couple of weeks ago, so I'm just waiting for the referees to jump on me. Maybe the referees in the audience, I don't know. So we invented a stochastic model of plasticity. Suppose that the fitness of the organism at time t is still given by equation 1, but it's now a stochastic variable. In terms of the pressure for the development of plasticity, it is the expected value of the fitness that is of interest, the mean. That is the time at which the plastic response t that maximizes the expected value of the fitness is of interest in determining the overall evolutionary path for the cohort. All right, so we just take Nishimura's model and make it stochastic. Here we go. Want some notation? We'll introduce alpha as the difference of the mu's. They're the predation rates in the two regions. Remember, mu1 was the biggest. Just this constant won't ever have to be worried about too much, so we'll call capital A there, and you can see why I've done that. It just makes the algebra simple, and little c will be the difference of the two individual per capita energy per unit of time energy consumption. So just rewriting it comes that. Let the time of the plastic response, now this is the assumption. I don't know why that chappie's got down there, he probably belongs somewhere else. He belongs up there. I've been using word machines in England, and now I've got to use your Linux here. That sigma up there, sigma t squared, should be in there. Apologies, I didn't notice that. I hope that gets corrected. Let the time of the plastic response be normally distributed random variable with mean, t bar, see that slipped down as well, t bar, and a variance sigma t squared. Note, and this is one of the critics when we tried this on a few people, made this mistake. Note, this is not assuming W is Gaussian, only its components. And I'm not sure whether we should use Gaussian, because of course we've got the problem of going into negative T. But think of it as a truncated Gaussian with a very little tail going into the forbidden region. So apologies, that's the mean is T bar, and the variance is sigma t squared. So we have to take the expected value of W. Well, we go back to our basic probability theory that we all learned at school. Expected value of that, you can see you can take the constant out. Those of you who are students, it's very easy. We want the expected value of this quantity. It's a linear operation, so we get this formula here. So that's pretty simple. This should be, usually in the paper we use little w of t as the mean of there, so I just think of that as the big W at the moment. All right, that's okay. Stage one calculus and everything else. The expected value of e to the minus t is something quite simple, and then you can get the expected value of t times this. This is with a normal distribution, please note. You get this formula here. Okay, that's taken as red. And then we get the expected value of W, that should be capital W, is this formula here. Note that, so this gives you the expected value of the plasticity in terms of the mean and the variance of the normal, presumed normal distribution. You could do this with a beta distribution if you wanted to as well. We haven't done that. Equation 3 is similar to the deterministic case with t replaced by that, pretty much. Okay, and so there's the formula we had before, and if you think about the change, you can make it into that. Okay? It has then two variables associated with the plasticity. The time, that is the expected value of the time of the response in relation to any environmental stimulus, and the variance of this response in the population of interest. So we would become second year calculus students and say we just got to maximize that with respect to those two variables, a function of two variables, that one at the bottom there, sorry, there, and we have to find its maximum. Then the bad news happens. The equations are inconsistent. Now we think about what our calculus teachers told us and say, well, that probably means that the maximum is on the boundary of the feasible region. Okay, partly, but we still thought, in fact, that it meant we had to think about which of these equations we'd want to use. We could use either of the alternatives. Now, what we chose to do is, we, like Nishimura, we focused on the value of t, that is t bar now, and saw that the variability is the more fundamental independent variable. We made that assumption, and if you do that, then you'll take the first of the two equations and get that expression here. This uses the first equation, which is the rate of change of the fitness with respect to t bar is zero. We've made a big step there, and we've made an assumption that should be criticized, or at least debated. This shows then that when the time of plasticity is stochastic, the mean time of plasticity is extended by an amount alpha sigma t squared. You see, that bit is Nishimura's solution. So we've extended the time with the variability. Interesting, isn't it, that that's the fact. If sigma t squared was zero, that would be back to the deterministic case, we get Nishimura's result. Okay, well, I've perhaps said all that. In this respect, variation in the response of plasticity in the population could be seen as an advantage in terms of providing extra time for the average response in the population to be most effective. However, in terms of the life history, by the way, that's the platform that I'm now helping lead. The mathematics of life history is what we're actually called and within this big center of research excellence. It analyzes, in terms of that analysis, the variance of the response to plasticity should be regarded as a variable of interest. I think I've said that. You could go round the other way, and one of our critics suggested that we should look for the variability in terms of t bar, and that would just invert the equation. We don't seem to need to do that. Now move on to the results of that little probability theory exercise. The results show that the maximum expected value of fitness is not given by a unique pair of functions for the average time of plasticity and the variance of plasticity, but rather by a set of numbers lying on a straight line in the plane of the time and variance, the average time and variance of the plasticity. So I'm repeating by the equation there. I've got the diagrams out of order. Oh, that one will do. I'll have to return to this diagram later on. This is one of those straight lines in the mean waiting time, variance of waiting time plane. And of course, we're only dealing with the positive octant. So all along there, if you make the assumption that the variance is the fundamental variable, I guess it should have been on the horizontal axis, we are somewhere on this line. So that's what it said. The kind of frequency distributions that we actually use are these truncated Gaussians. I think actually I'd like to redraw them to make the tail that's in the forbidden region much smaller. A population might not be on the optimal mean time. So we've got that result. That's established. We have a locus, as I showed you before, a straight line in the mean time variance plane or quadrant. A population may not be on the optimal mean time variance of plasticity for a number of reasons. For example, it might be sitting on that line and then the energy available might suddenly drop. Mum might start not eating properly, or as an example in Britain recently, might start drinking heavily. But that means the energy available to the fetus is suddenly dropped. So the question that we wanted to answer in order to support the hypothesis that Gluckman was making is, what would happen to that locus in that quadrant of mean time variance? Well, we proceeded along these lines. If the population ends up off the optimal line, where will it go to get to the new optimal line? You see, if E reduces, then you get another parallel line in the same plane. What we did then, to calculate this path, we made the assumption that the probability of the time t, or the average time t to switch states, remains Gaussian. This means that the new environment induces a similar average change in t across the population, preserving the Gaussian character. Now, a bit of calculus came to the fore now. I made the assumption and suggested to the others that the path of the population in that quadrant proceeds in a direction most favorable to the population. And that means that from the path from one point on one straight line moves to another one, that will always go on the steepest descent. I mean, it's simple calculus. The most, if you want to get there in the quickest time, you'll go down the steep path. And so we just followed that idea of steepest descent. So we just now have to do our two variable calculus. We like using X and Y. We use X as variance, Y as mean time. And then the line of steepest descent, if you call the function f of XY, the maximum value on the first line when the available energy is E1 is f of XY. That's just T bar. Sigma squared T bar. Now, Mum starts to not look after her health too well, so the energy available drops to E2, or may rise to E2. Mum might suddenly get some good medical advice and get better nutrition. So the line of steepest descent will be the differential equation dy by dx is df by dy by df by dx, which is perpendicular, of course, to the level curves of W1 as a constant. All right? And actually, I've got it going up the other way. I've made the energy level here a bit bigger. So Mum's obviously doing better. We were sitting here, and so we will move on the lines. There'll be lines everywhere. There'll be lines of a constant W in here. And there'll be constant W with the new energy level E2. So this is the high energy E2, this is the low energy E1, and of course, since this is also a level curve, you'll approach it perpendicular. And that shows the trajectory you'd get in that quadrant. Now, let's do an example. Now, this is a very small period, it's just a numerical example to illustrate the point. Consider a lifetime of phenotype expression of 100 days, an average energy level of 100 units, and mu1 being mu2, 0.2, and mu2 being 0.1. And this should be C0 and C1, they're round the wrong way. But all you really need is the difference of the C's anyway, so many units per day. And if the standard deviation is, say, 8 days for that population, if you work out what I said earlier, this has an optimal average time for optimal plasticity of 84 days. The deterministic calculation, by the way, is 77.7 days, that is 6.4 days less. Now, the energy available suddenly increases to 105 units. Then the equation, if you follow through the calculus that I've just done, the equations imply that the population will move to an optimal mean time of plasticity of, now it changes to 81.8 days. So it's come down, as you might expect, because the environment is better, with a standard deviation that is, of course, a bit bigger. Now, the extra energy available results in a shorter time to implement plasticity, because the population has more energy to spare on maintaining plasticity. Maintaining the ability to change, that's what plasticity is longer. So I've just put those outcomes in red. The black things are the ones that we were given for that recent calculation, and the outcomes are the ones in red. Let's move on to discussion, because remember, this is building a concept. The analysis presented here shows a relationship between the average time of plasticity and the variance of the time for plasticity. The higher the variance, the longer the average time for plasticity that maximizes the organism's fitness. The evolutionists like this, you see. They say variability in the population makes them better. And that's a paradigm in genetics, I think. If there was a constraint which acted to ensure that plasticity is required for some minimum time, the organism might adjust the variance of the time for plasticity to maximize fitness. I think most of these are just putting in words. I would like to use these slides for a medical audience quite soon, so I've just translated what the mathematics is saying into obvious words. So I won't read all that out. We have been playing with a deterministic generalization, and we haven't finished this work yet. It's certainly not on the paper that we submitted just recently. But we moved to introducing what the medical people call an environmental cue. And if an environmental cue is detected, the organism usually waits for a period T before initiating development of the induced phenotype, which might take time that should be TOR. One of the computers I was using while I was traveling didn't like Greek letters. Time TOR. During this waiting time, the constant per unit time cost of the yet to be induced phenotype is C1 and death rate mu1, and I've moved to C2, of course, rather than the C0. And there is a third interval now, third subinterval, and it's called. We've got a third interval where it's the developmental time here. That's the interval in which the cost per unit time of energy consumption is CD. So we have been floating the idea of doing exactly the same as Nishimura did with a deterministic model with these three subintervals. And you've got, of course, two variables in which the organism can choose in order to optimize fitness. T and TOR. And if you do all that, you have to make assumptions about the way in which the development cost depends on the subinterval. And these are just speculative arguments that we've used. It's just the same kind of calculus, so I won't worry about that too much now, because the stochastic bit is the bit that we're going to rest our case on. Some of the background papers. Another New Zealander, Hamish Spencer, which was published in American Naturalist in 2002, an early paper floating this idea, also appeared in the same journal way back in 92, and I'm optimistic about our paper, which has the same title more or less as my seminar, to appear. Well, it's being refereed at the moment. Let's see what happens. So the summary of this very controversial development is we know phenotypic plasticity is ubiquitous in the biological realm, and it has fundamental consequences for our understanding of evolution. I think most people realize that the environment affects what we are but we haven't had a lot of success in the past of quantifying that. And the realization that the induced response need not begin immediately after the environmental cue has certainly been underappreciated by evolutionary biologists. And that's the little bit that I showed you at the end, but I didn't show you the calculus for. But again, this will be on the PowerPoint that's going to be left here. Such a delay may have important consequences for fitness, and indeed some recent authors have argued that a number of phytotypic changes observed in adult humans and other mammals that have bad health effects, e.g. diabetes and hypertension, are in response to inappropriate environmental cues detected as a fetus or a newborn. It's further claimed that the physiological mechanisms underlying many of these delayed responses have been selected, and a very popular title to describe this is the predictive adaptive response, and I've learnt that new three-letter word, PAR. It's certainly an in topic amongst evolutionists. In summary, then, what we have done, we've extended Nishimura's model in four ways. We introduced a population cohort and focused on the probability distribution of development time. We allow the parameters during development to be different, albeit constant, from those during the waiting time which we introduced. We permit development time to be a variable and optimize it simultaneously with waiting time. Okay, and number four I didn't really develop. I think this will have, if it's ever published, enormous effect on phenotype plasticity and organism development understanding, especially for a fetus, where the ability to adapt is high. So I'll stop there for a moment with a pause for questions, and then I'll move on to the rather interesting mathematics that comes in my second biological part of the talk. Any questions you want to make at this time? What do you think? Please note the functional forms are speculative.
Is there any way that the two straight lines can be connected?
No, they're parallel, damn it. They're all of slope alpha, mu1 minus mu2. You'd have to... you can't do that. They're parallel. So if we make... You'd have to alter... What would you have to do? Now, they're all of slope alpha. And so if that's fixed, if the organism has a fixed predation rate in the first one and mu1, mu2, then the calculus says they're parallel. So it won't intersect. Would be nice, wouldn't it? But then these are lines at which the energy is constant. And if the energies are different, you don't want them to intersect, do you? Well, I don't know whether it would actually... Yeah. Well, not in our model, but I mean, you could possibly generalize the model in which that happens. I do hear what you're saying, but our diagram is correct for our assumptions. Thank you. Could be a...
Is it a question with the assumption that the genes are defective?
Yes, we have made the assumption of additivity, yes. I mean, are they? A medic could perhaps answer that question better. We have made that assumption. We were going for the simplest possible model that could encapsulate what medics say. But medic, if you ask a medic, is the effect additive, they won't know. They may not even know. Forgive me. Are you a medic? Okay. Forgive me. They may not know what additive means. I'm going to get thrown out, am I? I mean, one of the reasons I was quite happy to talk about it when Siv asked me is that there's a lot of very interesting problems like this that haven't been touched by mathematics. And this is on the extreme end of this, because there's no way you can check some of these assumptions. We're trying to build a conceptual model here to underpin what they say, but they haven't got any quantitative backup. So if we can build a model that helps, away we go, and that's what we've done. Okay, I like this slide because I've just become a grandfather for the fifth time while I've been travelling, so that's not a picture of my new grandchild. But shall I move on to the second part, because I was particularly, I didn't give it to serve as an option, because when I sent in the list of things I was doing, I was still writing this talk, but by the time I got to England 3 weeks ago, I had finished this talk that I'm going to show you. And I think it brings out another aspect of biology. It's set in the context of grass growth, because one thing New Zealand is very good on is growing grass. And I wanted to share with you this work, which produced some interesting mathematics, which is not in the literature. And yet, you know, us applied mathematicians are often told we're doing old mathematics in albeit in new situations. Well, that's not true in this next case. So if you just give me a moment to get the second one here, so we can close that one. Oh, I can just go down here, don't we? This is a shortened version of a talk I gave last week. It was called a distributed delay differential equation. That's my new four-letter word, triple DEs, model for the nitrogen cycle in pasture. And this is in collaboration with Tony Pleasance again. No, he's not on this list, sorry. Great, two ag research people and an exchange student who come from Bangkok in Thailand. And I will cover a similar sort of list of topics. A little bit of background on pasture dynamics. I'll show you a DVD clip of one of our chief scientists skiting about the clover ryegrass model. That's what we're thinking about, coexisting pastures helping and hindering each other to optimize the amount of grass that's grown, and therefore optimize the amount of meat we get from our 40 million sheep. So we need to have some pasture dynamics. I'll tell you briefly what triple DEs are, and I'll set you some homework. I'll talk about the model and show you some pictures. Here's the background. Intensively grazed temperate pastures are commonly grass-dominated, and the rate of herbage production is often very badly limited, and this is true around the world, but particularly true of our pastures, limited by availability of soil mineral nitrogen. That's one of the gases we want in the atmosphere. We've got 80% of it, of our atmosphere is nitrogen. And of course, it gets into plants. Plants absorb nitrogen and emit some oxygen. Soil mineral nitrogen supplied from the mineralization of soil organic matter is often supplemented by regular applications of fertilizer. That's why we fertilize our grass. However, in what we have done in New Zealand, and it's been taken up in other countries now, the major inputs to the soil pasture nitrogen animal cycle, because they eat the grass, are from the fixation of atmospheric nitrogen by the clover. Now, I've given it its biological name, symbiosis. And that's well known. So clovers supply nitrogen to convert it to mineral nitrogen in the soil. Clover, you don't want too much clover in your pasture, because it bloats the animals, and they therefore emit a very bad greenhouse gas called methane. So we want the right balance of clover. It doesn't grow very fast anyway. You really want the ryegrass that grows fast, but as I said before, it needs the nitrogen. There's a typical clover ryegrass mix, looking pretty nutritious if you're a cow or a sheep. You can see the clover in here, the mix is there. And what the clover is doing two things. It's putting the nitrogen into the soil, but it's also competing with the ryegrass for sunlight and whatever else. And just you can't really check it, but you can see that in the model you can mix up with different percentages of clover. And the one on the right has probably got too much. You wouldn't want to go over 40%. What are these percentages? These are percentages of kilograms of dry matter per hectare. So that's going to be the units of biomass. Well, it's really a density, isn't it? Now, the conceptual model that we have built is basically this. Clover is taking nitrogen out of the atmosphere, putting it into the soil and depositing it in mineral nitrogen, and it's helping the ryegrass grow bigger and faster, and the sheep get more to eat, or the cows. Now, I couldn't believe my good luck. Late one Saturday evening, I was watching television lying in bed, and I was watching the rural program on TV, and suddenly I saw one of the chief scientists in New Zealand talking about this. And I was just about to get ready to go to London to talk on this model, and I thought, gosh, you can't do better than that. So I thought I would show you the clip, and he makes some very interesting points. He is actually the CEO of one of our largest government scientific institutes, and that tells you a bit about what it is. It's a combination of research centres such as Ruakura, Grass, well, you won't know these places, but most importantly, a group of scientists and teams whose work at the heart of the pastoral industries. Remember, New Zealand is a population of 4 million people, but we can feed 100 million. And in a hungry world, that's going to be important. Rush to get more protein, particularly from our northern neighbours, is so fast that it's almost a bottomless pit in terms of the amount of protein they now want. So let me now show you the clip from Andy West. I hope this will work. I've been practicing all afternoon. I need to make that a bit bigger. No, that's... Oh, yeah, that's right. It's only about 5 minutes long, so bear with me.
Welcome back. My guest this week is the Chief Executive of Ag Research, Andy West. Andy, welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Andy, it's 40 years of field days, and we've chosen science as the theme. Now, is that about the past or about looking to the future?
New Zealand farming is our greatest enterprise that is scientifically based in this country. So what we've achieved in the past in terms of all the really quite unique farming systems, ryegrass, clover, sheep up on steep hillsides, whatever, deer. Those sorts of systems have been based on research, whether it's formal research in a laboratory or the sorts of innovation that farmers themselves undertake out in the fields. That's what's driven the industry in the past, and it's certainly what's going to drive in the future. In my personal view, farming needs science now more than it's ever needed science.
Well, I'll put you on the spot here. Tell us the top three scientific revelations you think that have helped farming get where it is in New Zealand, and the top three systems we're going to have to look at going forward.
Well, now you get my own personal prejudice, I suppose. I think looking back, you'd have to say, first of all, the ryegrass clover mix. That's pretty unique, the way that we've developed that, and we've really been able to make money out of it and sustain it. I think the way in New Zealand, we've turned to fertilisers and some of the micronutrients that have allowed us to make up for deficiencies of certain elements in soils. And I think the whole drive in the way that we've bred animals, and more recently, of course, we've moved into composites quite often, but the way that we've systematically and I think scientifically developed animals up to now. If you look forwards, what's going to be the next great, you know, drive? Hard to say, really, but I would say, first of all, precision farming. So the use of information and the tools that will allow you, like GPS or whatever, to precisely align fences, precisely apply fertilizer, precisely manage, not only for efficiency, but for minimal environmental footprint. I think the second one would have to be the new science of genomics, if you want. So that's like animal breeding or plant breeding on turbochargers, where you can really look at whole groups of genes and see how they affect the attributes that you're looking for, rather than individual interactions, individual genes. And the third would have to be really the ability, and science and technology only have one role to play, you know, there's only one role here, but the ability to integrate what you call a value chain from soil to a supermarket or to a carpet store. And so there's a full integration of what you're trying to achieve back on the farm all the way through to what the consumer wants at the far end of the chain. And selling by auction, like we do a lot of wool or whatever, is the absolute antithesis of that.
Are there going to need to be changes in the way science approaches farming?
Somehow we have to feed 9 billion humans by 2075 with a lower environmental footprint, potentially on less land, because with some of the ways that we're treating soil around the world, we're just losing it. So we've got to get more productive with a lower footprint. The only way we can do that is by using science and technology. There's no other way.
So getting back to field days, if I...
Okay, well that's, I saw that just a month or so ago, and it was nice that he actually mentioned the project that we had it done for them. So I'll stop that now. And show you what we did. Right, so we'll move on to my triple DEs. These are what I call, they could be called integral differential equations, but they're distributed delay equations. This is a bit of maths before we go back to the biology. These arise when the past affects the present. And the first one we teach our undergraduates is the rate dy by dt is y of t minus big T. And that's trivial, but we notice to make it well posed, we have to specify y in the immediate time interval, zero to minus t, or minus t to zero. And that has to be given to make it well posed. I always stop here and ask the audience, how do you solve that? It's a good aeroplane problem. The solution isn't e to the t. Do we know? You do know. I usually hope the students will know. It's you can't just separate the variables. Of course you'd use Laplace transforms, but the interesting thing is that it actually has an infinite dimensional solution set. Isn't it interesting? If capital T is zero, it's got a dimensional solution set of dimension one, and the minus t makes the set of independent solutions, if you like, of the equation, not with the initial condition, of course, infinite dimensional. There's a model here, is that if you want to model complex systems, delays are a good way of doing it. Okay, that's homework. Often the past effects might be distributed, and in the kind of model I'm going to show you, we'll have equations like this that I call the logistic DDE, where the I've simplified it a bit, where the logistic effect is distributed over the preceding time interval 0 to t. Now if capital T is large, of course you'd want a weighting factor in here, but just make it simple. And this is one equation that fascinated us, and I mention it because it's a problem that you can still find the analytical solution of this equation, like you can find the analytical solution of the point, the ordinary, if you replace this integral by y of t over k, you can also do it exactly. And of course I posed it as a problem for you, what is the solution? Well, I won't torment you any further, there's the exact solution. If you're over 35 like I am, you still quite like exact solutions. The solution is the hyperbolic cosine, hyperbolic secants. It's got all the constants in here, and the TM is the center of it there. And that's the exact solution of that distributed delay ODE, which has a point initial condition to make it well posed. And I'm thinking of y as biomass of grass. It's the kilograms of dry matter per hectare, and I'm just checking all the units there, time to the minus one and so on. It's an interesting solution. Think about how you might find it. Give you a hint, you just replace that integral there by a new variable z of t, and then you get a pair of coupled non-delayed ODEs that you can solve in the phase plane. There's the solution plotted out. logistic distribution. I call it the logistic distribution. It occurs quite a lot in probability theory. It's an alternative to Gaussian. It hasn't got such a steep descent. If you make the same mean, then you actually get sometimes it's a better distribution to use than the Gaussian. So the solution always looks like that. So you'd only have to specify y naught there, and it goes up to a peak at the value Tm and asymptotes to zero. So it's a nice solution, and it's the kind of one that we got stuck into when we got the ryegrass clover model, which I'll now return to. That's a little bit of an aside on triple DEs. And I wanted to ask anyone, has anyone seen that exact solution in the literature? Okay. The trick that I mentioned of calling that a new function is well known, of course, in delay equations. Model development. Clover content in pastures is commonly considered to be smaller than optimum, and it's also subject, I'm just quoting the biologists here who looked at the data sets, and subject to large fluctuations in time. The proportion of clover in pasture and rate of nitrogen fixation has a large environmental impact for minerals and the wider community. You don't want too much nitrogen in there because it'll affect the water table. And one of the effects that we've just published in the Journal of Agricultural Science is high density stocking near lakes and rivers causes so much nitrate in our beautiful lake in the middle of the country, which I'll show you a picture of in a moment. It's now getting so much nitrate that too much weed is growing, and it affects the recreational use of that rather beautiful lake. And this must be true in Ontario as well. You've got large farming near your beautiful lakes. The observed variability over time in clover content has been in the past attributed to environmental factors, plant mortality due to adverse climate, pests or diseases. Might be true, but there are also intrinsic reasons for this variability relating to the interactions between coexisting clover and grass, and that's one of the outcomes of our model. Soil nitrogen availability has a powerful effect on clover-grass proportions, clovers being more competitive when nitrogen availability is low, while grasses dominate, where nitrogen availability is high in part because of the uptake of nitrogen from the soil is more efficient than a combination of uptake and fixation. That's all simple bookkeeping. The principal role played by soil nitrogen, mineral nitrogen in the soil is difficult to measure. You can see that the obvious thing to do in dynamical systems terms is to have three compartments: the clover, the ryegrass, and mineral nitrogen concentrations. So I said that to the biologists, and they said, no, can't do that. We haven't got any data for soil nitrogen. Build a model, they said, whipping me, that didn't have nitrogen as a dependent variable. So what we had to do is to somehow mimic the effect. You notice I've used that word in the next paragraph. For these reasons, a simple model involving only clover and ryegrass standing masses and including a mechanism to mimic the effect of soil nitrogen without having an explicit pool is formulated. And so that's what we had to do, noting that we were not capturing that process of mineralization of nitrogen chemically, we were mimicking its effect. Okay, so the biologists have talked us into having the state variables of standing masses of time t of clover, c of t naturally, and ryegrass r t. I've told you about units before. Now, if they weren't interacting, you'd expect a simple logistic effect, right? Just two logistic equations uncoupled. And that's undergraduate calculus to solve those. But we have to introduce a competition. We have to introduce possible removal by grazing animals. The animals are fairly selective. If they can, they'll eat the ryegrass, but of course they'll get some clover as well because they can't separate it out. So that means the Clover equation is an amended logistic equation. DC by DT is C of T, Pacific growth rate there, carrying capacity of CM, but competition from the ryegrass, which is coexisting, and then removal by the animals, will make that a per capita rate. Depends on the stocking rate, clearly, which isn't in this model. Now, noting what our biologist said, we didn't try to attempt to describe the nitrogen cycling explicitly, since it would require introducing a variable for the soil nitrogen, which is extremely difficult to measure. So we grasped at some straw, no pun intended. We introduced a gross simplification of the complex processes which incur over various timescales when clover fixes nitrogen in an attempt to capture the essence of the fixation mechanism. Of course, two of our co-authors are agriculturalists, so we had pretty good advice. These processes, including growth of clover tissue from the fixed nitrogen, senescence of that tissue, so it takes a time before it dies and rots, and the subsequent mineralization which makes the nitrogen available in a form that can be used for ryegrass growth. Instead of describing these processes explicitly, we do it through a delayed approach. Now, we note that the amount of clover turnover in a time is a multiple of how much is there. It's HC, we'll call that a constant. The total amount of clover turnover from an earlier time, T minus capital T 2 days ago, to T minus T1, all the units of time are days here, T minus T1, and it will make T2 bigger than T1, so that's a simple calculation. The enhancement effect on current ryegrass growth of the total amount of clover turnover in that period is assumed to be a Michaelis-Menten type response. We got that from data fitting. And so the actual model for the ryegrass is this interesting effect. Let's go through the terms. This is the real novelty of the model, is in this equation. The ryegrass, it's no spatial structure here at the moment. Logistic effects, there's the originalistic effect. Here's the enhancement of the growth from the clover, and notice it's picking up the clover at earlier times. And there's the Michaelis-Menten effect in this curly bracket term. There's the Michaelis-Menten effect. If A was zero, then you'd be back to the no-delay case. And you've introduced, of course, some new constants that you have to interrogate the data set to actually find. We've retained the competition from the clover for sunlight and so on, and removable animals. So the model that we built and used to underpin the sort of thing that Andy West said, was these coupled pair of ODEs. And the novelty is the distributed delay, which is why I had that in the title of the talk. So it's all downhill from here, compute and run. Of course, it wasn't necessarily the first thing we found. It took us a long time to get here. T1 and T2, the biologists tell us, are of the order of months rather than days or years. And the typical value is T1 is 90 days and T2 is 270 days. And so the current availability of mineral nitrogen to the ryegrass is from clover turnover in a 6-month period from 9 to 3 months ago. The bad news is there are 11 dimensional parameters in the model and one dimensionless parameter A. So we've got 12 parameters to find. We didn't find it useful, by the way, to non-dimensionalize the equations because it didn't reduce the number of variables very much. Some of the constants, though, the biologists knew. They certainly knew GC, GR, CM, and RM. They gave us ballpark figures for the competition factors E and F, and of course these were control variables. These were variables to do with stocking rates. The new ones are B, T1 and T2, they pretty much knew, were the 3 and 9 months respectively. The newer A is, of course, a direct consequence of our model. So we've only got about 4 parameters that we had to use the typical inverse fit to do. Of course, to make it well posed, we have to specify the ryegrass concentration at earlier times. What do you do with that model? You do the classical dynamical systems approach, look for steady states, which is the maximum of 5, and look for hop bifurcations, and so on. Hop bifurcations for delay equations are hard, but the latest version of MATLAB, of course, has a delay add-on. But not distributed delay, and someone in London told me 2009 it will have. But we solved it another way. We did all the path following by reducing it to, you can get rid of the delay by another variable, as many of you will have seen. There are 5 steady states, maximum of 5. I've listed them here. There's the Saudi Arabian desert. There's monocultures of clover and no ryegrass. There's monocultures of no clover and some ryegrass. And then there's the coexisting solutions, which is where you want to be. So you need to interrogate these equations to find out what parameter spaces we'll put in there. Our scientists have genetically modified clover to help get us in that region. Is genetic modification allowed in Canada? Anyone know? Well, we've certainly done it. It is. A great uproar from the Greens Party, of course, but it's been done for clover. Not all feasible, they're not all feasible, those steady states. It depends on the parameter values. There are stability swaps, as you might expect, and we found the steady states were crucially dependent on the difference of the, that's the sort of time span of the rotting of the clover, the dead clover, and not on the actual values. So one of the important control variables for the genetic modification was affecting that. So you'll find when I produce the outcomes, and I've nearly finished, Siv, these will be the two control variables. And hop bifurcation is certainly possible, and they were supercritical hops. But they were hard to find because of the triple DE nature of the model. Well, I won't show you much of the horrible mathematics. It's in a, some of it will be in a paper that I'll show you, but that's an early version of what this is. The parameters, the value of A means that the enhancement effect of the clover turnover on ryegrass growth saturates at a level 4 times that of ryegrass grown alone. That's interesting. The value of B means, and so on. Most of the other parameters have been estimated using data from various field yield trials. Actually, it was interesting that when we started on this problem 6 or 7 years ago, the biologists had 30 years of data from controlled pastures, and they've been collecting all this data and never thought about what it meant. And it was only in 2002, when we came along, that this explanation of what was going on was possible. Well, I'll jump straight to the outcomes diagram, which is the main feature of it. Massive computation in order to find these. You find that the parameter space T1 here in days, the difference T2 minus T1 in days here. So T2 equals T1, of course, is this axis along here. But of course, we don't want to be there. As I say, T2 minus T1 is typically 6 months or 180 days. So the outcome diagram is roughly a diagram like that. It's not been terribly well drawn, I'm sorry. This interesting little cusp here. In region 1, you get clover or ryegrass monocultures. In region 2, you can have either of these, depending on the parameter values. Where do you want to be? You might want a periodic solution, which is a limit cycle. Basically, you want to be in where the periodic solution is stable, or you can have you could also want to be in region 2. But the oscillations were well known, and it's in region 3 that it actually happens. Now, these are where you'll be is also parameter dependent, of course. So I'll just show you some phase portraits and finish. The first one will have T2 minus T1 a lot less with varying values of T1. And I'll just show you the trajectory for 100 days as the other trajectories are almost identical. So that's a typical phase diagram there, and obviously we've chosen an initial condition so you get all clover. You wouldn't want to be there. Disaster for the animals. They would eat too much clover and develop bloat, really. So that's the kind of thing. And most of them are able. You can notice I put over here, I've also put over here the other steady state there, but obviously this initial condition wasn't in the basin of stability of that steady state. There's also a monoculture up there of just ryegrass. Not a very good pasture because there's not much soil nitrogen. Here's the interesting phase portrait. When you take T2 minus T1 just under 3 months with varying values of T1 and starting with an initial condition, you can end up in different places. Now this is a surprise phase portrait. It's interesting, of course, that you start here at little t equals naught and the trajectory is still going to track in to the coexisting steady state inside the periodic solution, which in this case is unstable. Now you couldn't do this in a purely local term. The reason you can cross periodic solutions in the phase plane is because of the delay. So the theorem that tells you phase portraits the trajectory shouldn't cross is invalid here. So this would be quite a good situation to be where the coexisting steady state is attracting. And in most cases, well, it's not globally attracting. I mean, you could sit on this knife edge periodic solution, but of course it's a set of measure zero, really. The last case I'll show you is when the difference is over 3 months and the long-term outcome is ryegrass monoculture irrespective of T1. You wouldn't want to be here. Okay, conclusions. The feature of the model is a nitrogen fixation mechanism that attempts to describe the beneficial effects of clover on ryegrass without explicitly introducing a nitrogen variable. And we've done local analysis of the model together with some simulations using those as control parameters. You've got the six possible outcomes, five steady states, many of which are undesirable, especially the desert. Fortunately, the desert is always unstable. And that's an interesting point in itself. And they range over these various outcomes, and I think I've said all that. We were immediately able to explain the dichotomy in Thornley's paper in 1995, where he had large-scale fluctuations, but always settled into coexistent equilibrium. He had not incorporated a distributed delay. Some early work on this work was in this paper that I've referenced at the bottom here. It's been updated recently because of the genetic modification of the clover, and that's why it was in the forefront of my mind for the mini symposium on maths and agriculture in London last week, where I spoke about this. And so that's the little saga about the use of distributed delay differential equations in an agricultural setting. So I'll stop there with some questions and comments showing you one of our mountains. It wasn't one that was in Middle Earth. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Okay, any questions? Have you reached a stage where you're going to have a plug-and-play software for farmers so they can do optimal strategy?
Oh, yes. Because one of the nice things about New Zealand Department of Agriculture is it provides teams of farm advisors that go around advising, farmers on the best strategy, and our